We are now in our third week of a series that I've called What Jesus Saw from the Cross. And we're trying to wrestle with what was going to the cross like for Jesus. What was it from his perspective? What did he see? What did he hear? What did he think? What did he feel? Because it's not a perspective we often take, and I think it's a pretty interesting one. But for two sermons, I haven't been near the cross. We talked about what Jesus was like, because I think that was sort of foundational for trying to think like Jesus. And we looked at the episode of him raising Lazarus from the dead, because I think it gets you a little hint into the emotional life of Jesus, that he wept, that he got angry at death. And remember that this is right before he's going to go to the cross. And so it's sort of setting the stage, sort of a precursor, sort of a looking ahead to his own death. And now we're zooming ahead. We're going to actually get to the cross. And we're going to start on Maundy Thursday. And today we're going to look at the trials, the arrest, and the trials of Jesus. But let me just fill in that week, Holy Week, kind of quickly. We had Palm Sunday, where Jesus came into town riding on a donkey with a crowd, waving palm branches and yet shouting, "Hosanna, save us." During the week, Jesus stayed in Bethany, which is where Lazarus and Mary and Martha were from, and he would come into town about the 2 miles every day, and he would teach in the temple, and he would get into some trouble there. He had some conflicts with the people. The Pharisees and scribes would try to test him. He cleansed the temple, so he knocked over all these money changers and then this would have ruined the day at the temple because nobody could do business. Everybody just had to try to clean up and sort stuff out. He cursed a fig tree. He taught and had several controversies. And then on Thursday, he began to settle down at an upper room, at a guest room, so that he could celebrate Passover with his disciples. There he did the first of the meals that we're going to have later today, the communion. He had the sacrament of communion was instituted. He predicted that his disciples would abandon him, that one would deny him, and that one would betray him. After Passover, Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane. Okay, so this is a garden at the bottom of the Mount of Olives. The word Gethsemane is like press, like a wine press. So what you would do is you would take all the olives and you would bring them down to the base of the mountain where you would have a press to crush them and make them into whatever products you were making normally. Olive oil, right? And so there's a garden down there where this kind of stuff would happen. He goes there. Seems to be a place he would go often. He liked it. It was on the way. Now, he could have, if he wanted, gotten away from there. I mean, if he had just gone right over the Mount of Olives, he could have been in the Judean wilderness in like another mile and totally gotten away. So he goes to the Garden of Gethsemane first to pray, to prepare himself mentally, and spiritually, and emotionally for what's going to happen. And he struggles with it. He's so anxious, he sweats drops of blood for what's about to happen. He knows. But he also goes there so that he can be arrested. He's not running away from being arrested. And they've been scared of the crowds, and there have been so many people around him that they haven't been able to arrest him publicly. So Jesus gives them this chance to arrest him privately. He goes where he knows Judas Iscariot can find him. And here's how the story plays out. I'm going to be reading today a couple sections of Mark. This is Mark 14, starting in verse 43. And immediately, while he was speaking, Judas came, one of the 12, and with him a crowd with swords and clubs from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. Now the betrayer had given them a sign, saying, "The one I will kiss is the man. Seize him and lead him away under guard." When he came, he went up to him at once and said, "Rabbi," and he kissed him. And they laid hands on him and seized him. But one of those who stood by drew his sword and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear. And Jesus said to them, "Have you come out against a robber with swords and clubs to capture me? Day after day I was with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But let the scriptures be fulfilled." And they all left him and fled. So Judas brings this crowd. This crowd implies it's a pretty big group. and they're armed with swords and clubs. Some of them seem to be soldiers, others just people loyal to the Pharisees and the scribes. How does Judas know he's going to be there? Does he talk about that earlier in the meal, or is this just common practice that Jesus liked this place and stopped to pray there often, so Judas knew he was probably going to stop there? Judas brings this crowd, and they have a prearranged symbol. The one I kiss, that's the one you should arrest. They bring chains just before the occasion. Kissing in that society was a greeting, especially of family. This sounds really weird to us because we don't kiss publicly. But in those days, it was something that you did with your family, you kiss, at least kiss on the cheek. Okay? And it was somebody that was somebody that you respected and you esteemed, somebody that was sort of your superior, like your rabbi. You might come up and you might kiss them on the hand. So this sounds a little weird to us, this kiss, but it might have been on the hand. It doesn't say that it was on his face. And it wasn't as weird in those days, but it was a very personal moment, right? Because what Judas could have said is, hey, the one that I say hello to first, that's the one. The one I tap on the shoulder, that's the one. There have been attempts to try to make Judas out to be a little more heroic and a little less self-seeking. This is the move of somebody who's bitter. This is a serious betrayal. It's personal and it's cruel. And imagine for Jesus, and he had called it at the dinner. He knew Judas was already betraying him. But imagine you have a friend, a student, a brother, someone you poured 3 years of your life into, come up and betray you. And not just betray you with a kiss. The disciples want to fight, but they're fishermen. They're not trained for this. They have swords, apparently, so they were ready for a fight. They knew that they could be killed if they came towards Jerusalem. But one of them, and Mark doesn't say who, we know that it's Peter from other Gospels, he takes and tries to swing his sword, and he cuts off an ear. Well, if he cuts off an ear, first of all, what's he going for? He's going for the head and neck. Okay? He's going to kill. Okay? And if he chops off the ear, it means he's really bad at it. Okay? These are fishermen. They're not ready for this battle. They will lose this battle. The crowd of swords and clubs cannot hope for the 11 of them, fishermen, tax collectors, to beat this crowd, no way. Chops off the ear. In the other Gospels, we know that Jesus heals the man and puts the ear back on. There are always those who are wounded by the efforts of the church. Always those for whom Jesus' followers hurts them. And there's special care that Jesus gives for those who are hurt by his followers. Not only does Jesus not resist arrest, they won't let the disciples fight. And he says, in the gospel, one of the Gospels, he says, I can have legions of angels come and defend me. I don't need you fishermen with your swords. I can get... So again, there's this huge emphasis in the Gospels that Jesus is being arrested. He is letting himself be arrested. He's not caught up in some plot. It's a plot he predicted. It's a plot he put himself in a position to be arrested. And it's a plot he does nothing to resist. And when the disciples see that Jesus is resigning himself to his captors, what do? They flee. We're going to give, when Peter gets shamed a lot because he denies Jesus, he's the only one that even stuck with him that long. Okay, actually, Peter, being the denier of Jesus, was probably the bravest of the disciples because he's the only one that kept following Jesus. Maybe John for a little while. But all the other disciples simply fled. And now, Jesus is so very alone. After Jesus is arrested, he basically goes through six trials. Three Jewish trials, a hearing before Annas, a trial before Caiaphas, and then a final judgment before the Sanhedrin. And then he really goes through kind of three Roman trials. He goes before Pilate. Pilate tries to kick him over to Herod. Herod sends him back to Pilate again. So the first trial of Jesus happens in the house of a man named Annas. Annas had been the high priest from 6 to 15 AD. But he's called a lot of times in the text the high priest. Kind of like if you met any previous president, what would you call him? Mr. President, right? You keep the title, you keep the, you know, you still, when former presidents are on the news, they're still called President so-and-so. Okay, so he's still called the high priest. And he seems to have a lot of influence. In fact, Annas will have 5 sons that will also be high priests. And at the time, the current high priest is a man named Caiaphas. Caiaphas looms huge. He's the longest standing high priest of this time, from AD 18 to 36. And he married one of Annas' daughters. Okay, so Caiaphas is going to have a run where one high priest is going to be his son-in-law, and then 5 of his sons are going to be high priests. Not a lot happened without Annas and Caiaphas behind it. You got to understand that this is the first family of priesthood right here in the first century. So Annas, he has a hearing first. Basically, he listens to the case, and then he sends it over to Caiaphas. They probably live, because they're family, they probably live either in the same complex of houses or in the same sort of ritzy part of town. Let me read Mark's short accounts of how the trial went. And Mark is not specifying Caiaphas versus Annas. He's just giving you kind of the account. Okay, verse Mark 14:53. And they led Jesus to the high priest. And all the chief priests and elders and scribes came together. Peter had followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting with the guards and warming himself by the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood and bore false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy the temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands.' Yet even about their testimony did not agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, 'Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?' But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the priest asked him, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?' Jesus said, 'I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power, coming with the clouds of heaven.' And the high priest tore his garments and said, 'What further witness do we need? You have heard this blasphemy. What is your decision?' And they all condemned him for deserving death." So, in this story, and from the other gospel accounts, there are many accusations swirling around this hearing. Some argue that Jesus said he had the power to forgive sins. Others try to testify that he healed on the Sabbath. Some try to say that he did exorcisms with the authority of Satan. Some claim, like you read here, that he had power over the temple, saying he could destroy it and rebuild it at will. On top of that, the leaders of Israel were worried that Jesus had devoted followers and growing crowds of sympathizers. I mean, what was this little movement in the Galilean hills, right? In like the backcountry is one thing. But here's what's happened in the last couple weeks for them. Jesus has raised Lazarus from the dead in Bethany in front of a whole bunch of people from Jerusalem. And when Jesus comes to Passover, people line the streets and wave palm branches for this guy. This is not just any Galilean movement now. Now, it seems like Judea, all of Israel, is starting to get behind this person. But you can hear the problem with the trial, right? They have false witnesses. There are contradictions in the testimony. There's not a very discernible case to be made. And a lot of things that Jesus has said in the Bible, if you go back through, this is particularly true in Mark, any claims that Jesus has had that he is the Son of God or that he is the Messiah, he's made in private. In other words, all these people that are in the crowds didn't hear him say it. They need, if they really want to get Jesus, they need one of his disciples to be a witness in this case.
To all this, Jesus said nothing. He could have easily mounted a defense, and the case is falling apart. No credible witnesses, but he's silent. Fulfilling, as people would look back and see Isaiah 53:7, right? He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. So finally the trial comes to an impasse, and they can't do anything because they don't have enough witnesses, they don't have enough testimony. And in these days, they really didn't have pretty elaborate systems for how you had to present evidence and how these things had to go. So finally, Annas and Caiaphas have to start questioning Jesus directly, because if Jesus is going to be quiet, none of these witnesses are going to give them enough evidence to convict. So they ask Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. And Jesus to them in the other gospel says, look, I taught publicly. I taught in the synagogues. I taught in the temple. I taught for the world to hear. How come you can't tell me what I said? You can't get witnesses to say it. But what Jesus will not do is denying his identity and his destiny. So when he's asked if he is the Christ, what does he say? I am. Now the word I am is huge. The word I am is the name of God in Hebrew that is given at the burning bush. So Yahweh, but it means I am. That's what he says. Okay? So when he's asked if he is the Christ, he says, Yahweh, yeah, I am. That's blasphemy, everybody. I mean, if it's not true, if you're not actually God at that moment, it is totally blasphemy. Okay? And then he makes reference to, you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds. Yeah, Jesus will not deny who he is and his destiny, what he came to do. So the Caiaphas rips his clothes. That's the sign that the trial is over. He has condemned himself at this point. And the group agrees that he is guilty. Now, what's interesting about this is at the same time, and we're not looking at all the texts, at the same time, Jesus is on trial among these major religious leaders. Peter is on trial in the garden from a servant girl. Are you one of his followers? And Peter three times denies him. But you got to understand, why does Peter deny that he knows Jesus? Because he doesn't want to get dragged in to testify. Okay? If in that moment he gets, yeah, you're a follower of Jesus, well, we need a witness to talk about what he said. He's going to get yanked in there. But he denies Jesus and then runs away. Now Jesus is truly alone. Early in the morning then, Jesus was taken to the Temple Mount where a third Jewish trial was held before the entire Sanhedrin, all the religious leaders of Israel, basically to ratify the decision that's already been made at Caiaphas' house to find him guilty. He's found guilty of being someone who seduces or entices people. In other words, he's accused of misleading Israel, turning Israel away from God. It'd be the same as if he got people to worship Baal or some other god. That's what he's accused of. Not just blasphemy, but actually misleading and misguiding Israel. And they decide that he is so powerful that he's getting so many followers, he's got to be put to death. The problem is, the Sanhedrin is not allowed to kill anybody. Only Rome has the power of life and death. Okay, so the Sanhedrin can beat someone, they can hurt someone, they can shame and shun someone. They cannot have anyone killed. Only Rome can do that. And so they've got to take Jesus to a Roman trial. Then take him to Pilate. Pilate is called the Roman prefect of Judea. A king kind of ruled independently. Like, the Roman Empire was so big that they ruled in different ways. Sometimes they had a king. Like, King Herod, when Jesus was born, was a king. He had a little more independent rule of his own place as long as he played ball with Rome and paid tribute to Rome. But when Rome didn't like how local leaders did, they would rule more directly, and they would send instead a prefect, somebody who would, like, administratively control. They had a lot of control. They're almost a king. But they actually answered to Rome more for what they do. That's what Pilate is. So the Sanhedrin go to Pilate, first thing in the morning on Friday. They accuse Jesus of perverting the nation. They talk about him stirring up the people, that he is a deceiver and an imposter. Right? Because Rome's not going to execute anybody for violating Jewish law. Rome doesn't care about Jewish law. Rome cares about Roman law. You only get crucified if you're against Rome, if you're guilty of sedition. So Pilate begins to hear this case, and he, like the Sanhedrin at first, doesn't see a lot of case. There's a lot of testimony that's sort of messed up. So we're now in Mark 15. And as soon as it was morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council, and they bound Jesus, led him away to be delivered over to Pilate. Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus answered him, "You said so." And the chief priests accused him of many things. And Pilate again asked, "Have you no answer to make? See how many charges they bring against you." But Jesus made no further answer. So the Pilate was amazed. Now at the feast, he used to release one prisoner of whom they asked. And among the rebels in prison was one who committed murder in the insurrection. There was a man named Barabbas. And the crowd came up and began to ask Pilate to do as he usually did for them. And he said to them, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" For he perceived that it was out of envy that the chief priests had delivered him. But the chief priest stirred up the crowd and said, "Release for them Barabbas instead." Pilate again said to them, "Then what shall I do with this man you call the king of the Jews?" And they cried out again, "Crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Crucify him." So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas, and having Jesus scourged, delivered him to be crucified. Pilate, in historical fact, was not a nice guy. Like, if you read the story, you might think, "Oh, Pilate, he's so generous. He likes to release prisoners sometimes, and he's trying to get Jesus off the hook." Pilate was cruel. He was deeply political, and this is actually very out of character for the historical Pilate. But what the text implies, and you can develop this out of several Gospels, is that Pilate didn't see the case. He didn't see how Jesus was that much of a problem. Jesus wasn't like yelling and trying to fight it. He was really calm. Pilate couldn't see the case. Furthermore, you read the stories, Pilate was warned by his wife. His wife had had a dream and said, "No, Jesus is innocent. Do not crucify this man." And so Pilate does what he can to get Jesus off the hook. Okay, first, it's not in Mark, but we know that he tries to send Jesus to Herod. See, if Jesus, Pilate is the head of Judea, okay, but Herod, one of the sons of Herod the Great, is running Galilee. And he is in town for the festival of the Passover. So Herod gets this idea, "I'll kick it to Herod." The Herod mocks Jesus, but Herod is kind of smart and knows not to get in the way of what's going on. So he kicks Jesus back over to Pilate. Pilate then tries to say, "There's no case here." But people keep demanding that he's going to die. He tries to offer Jesus as the released prisoner, right? So he can be guilty, but then we let him go. But the crowd wants who? Barabbas. Finally, he threatens to release Jesus. And he does this a couple times. And one time, the crowd really gets mad and says no. But then there's another time where he says, "I don't see a case here. I can't." And the Sanhedrin actually start to accuse Pilate. What they say is, "We're going to report you to Rome for letting someone live who was actually seditious if you don't crucify this man." So now Pilate is being threatened himself because of what has happened. And at that point, we know from the story, he washes his hands with the blood of Jesus. He sits down on the bima, the it's called the bench where a Roman would sit to make it. Still, if you go to court, you're asked to approach the bench. The judge sits at a bench. It's the same thing in Roman days. So he sits down on a bench and declares Jesus guilty. Now, the other interesting thing is he puts what Jesus is guilty of on a sign on the cross. This was very common to put why someone was being crucified onto a sign on the cross. And what does he put on the cross? It says, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. That's what he puts on the cross. And the Sanhedrin get mad at this. They say, why don't you say, he said he was the King of the Jews. But Pilate actually sticks to his guns and leaves King of the Jews on, almost as if Pilate knows, this man really may have been the King of the Jews. So, a couple things about this to close. As you hear about these trials, what was it like for Jesus? How frustrating was it? How alone he must have felt? But again and again and again, we got to say this, that Jesus had so many ways out of the cross. He could have not gone to Jerusalem at all. He could have not chosen Judas. He could have run over the Mount of Olives and gotten away. He could have let his disciples fight. He could have called angels to fight him. He could have put up a defense when the trial wasn't going anywhere. And yet Jesus, again and again and again, is actually choosing the cross. We got to say that. He's not wrapped up in some plot against it. He's choosing the cross. Why? Because it's not just about his. This isn't just about his trial. This is not him being guilty. He's actually on trial here with us. We are guilty. And Jesus is going through this for us. And so he's taking on the punishment for us. So we're being declared guilty, and then he's taking the punishment for us. But actually, in a little bit of an ironic twist, too. Of all these things that are being thrown around about Jesus, that he's the Son of God, that he leads people to worship, that he's Lord of the temple, that he can forgive sins, that he stirs people to change and follow him, those are really bad if he's falsely saying those things. But if he's guilty and they're true, those are actually really good news. Actually really good news. Maybe he's more guilty of these things than they even realize. And then in an ironic way, Jesus is actually being proclaimed by Pilate and by others to have really been who he said he was. So this week made me reflect on the trial, the arrest, and what this was like for Jesus. It made me thankful that he didn't avoid the cross, but for your sake, he kept going towards the cross. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.